You're listening to the Speech Uncensored podcast. Join us for weekly discussions diving into all the particulars of communication, voice, swallow, and cognition with tangible applications to the world of medical speech and language pathology. Additional resources and the discussion guide for this episode are in specially curated show notes on speechuncensored.com. This week, I'm sitting down with Amanda Hitchens to find out what it's like to partner with an organization overseas to provide SLP services. We're going into the differences between actually doing good work versus feeling good work. And Amanda has a list of 10 questions to ask before volunteering with an organization in a developing or a majority world country. I know I'm interested in learning more. So without further ado, my name is Leanne Porter. I'm your host. And now let's meet Amanda. Hi, Amanda. How's it going?
Hi, Leanne. I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm so happy to have you on the podcast today.
Thank you so much.
All right. So before we jump into our topic, I want to learn a little bit more about you. So tell me who you are and where you are and what it is you do.
So I am a speech pathologist for about 10 years now. I am a 2012 graduate of the Mass General IHP program. I've been working in outpatient rehab, mostly PD the entire time, with little stints as a per diem at a SNF in the Boston area.
All right. Very good. So we're just going to jump right in and Sure. Let's talk a little bit about white saviorism, voluntourism, and the problems with those things.
Absolutely. So I kind of hopped into this field on the voluntourism side of things and learned quite quickly the problematic aspects of it. I entered the world of volunteering in Africa through my undergraduate internship with a microbiologist who was working for Merck, distributing an anti-parasitic drug in the Congo, which sounds tangential, but at the time I was a public health major and not into speech. So he took me with him to a conference in Tanzania, which I went all sort of naively and excited to be helping, quote unquote, as a college student who didn't know a whole lot about anything really. But when you think that you're a college educated American, you think you know a lot of things. Very quickly, in just having chats with people, I think it was my taxi driver who got comfortable with me and sort of said, you know, you guys come all the time. You stay for a couple weeks. You go on a safari. You might, you know, teach a class and then you leave and you never come back. You take pictures of our kids. Very blunt conversation with him about what good we are actually doing when we're there. So Americans are going to Africa, or I should say Americans, Europeans, et cetera, people from wealthier countries are sending their young people to places like Africa with naive notions of the good that they're going to do, taking pictures of their children, teaching a class or two, going to see some animals, going to a nightclub, then going home with this great fulfilling experience that they've had. But the people in the countries that they were in are not feeling the same. It's not a mutually beneficial setup right now. So a big part of what I've been involved in and thinking about over the last 10 years is how to make sure and how to assess that that relationship is more mutually beneficial. And thinking about sort of how self-centered we can be when we talk about these experiences. Like if you talk to a 20-year-old who's just come back from Rwanda, are they talking about how it helped them and how it opened their eyes? Or are they able to talk objectively about what they did for the people in their service population?
And something that I'm sure you're going to get to, because it's in your list of 10 questions, but really like speaks very loudly to me, is something you've also touched about in your own personal story is, what's the sustainable nature of the work you're doing? Like, is it something that can be continued? And is it something that is actually beneficial to the population that you're involved in? Because we often have these notions of what we think other people need. And I know that if you went through public health, then you got a heavy dose of this too, is recognizing, separating what we think people need from what the community would actually benefit from.
Yes, exactly. And a great example of that in specific speech terms is dysphagia. We have modified barium swallows as our standard of care for assessing dysphagia. Anytime you bring up a dysphagia issue, the first thing somebody asks is, did you do an MBS? in the Congo, where there is not even electricity in the vast majority of the service area that I work in, getting an MBS is about as realistic as, you know, sending somebody to Mars for a weekend. It's not going to happen. So I could have a shoot for the moon goal of, hey, let's get an MBS machine and train some radiologists down there and do an MBS. But A, are people going to be able to access it? And B, is it something that people can afford? C, how are we maintaining that equipment? D, how are we making sure that once I'm gone, whoever's using that equipment is using it effectively and is trained properly? There's no objective measures. There's no way to check in. The electricity surges a lot. Even if you do have it, it's usually generator-based. So a lot of their plug-in equipment is susceptible to failing because of power surges. So is it more effective to say, hey, we're going to bring an MBS and bring the best possible care? Or do we focus on training the caregivers, the nurses, the children who are caring for their aging parents, how to do oral care, how to position their loved ones for eating, all of those sort of less technical, but more helpful in a broader sense techniques. So that's, you know, just one example of how we focused on applying cultural considerations to the need.
Mm-hmm. And I just had kind of another thought to spin off of, let's say you achieved that shoot for the moon goal, you got a mobile MBS machine there. So now we're doing MBSs. Well, some of those recommendations following a video swallow study might be alternative means of nutrition. Now, how will that fit in with the culture? How will that fit in with access to creating like a PEG tube or a J tube? Like it keeps cascading. And so many other things need to be in place before you just jump in and be like, well, like you need a modified barium swell, like the machine to do it. So
exactly. So the comparison I've used when I've talked about this with college students is those Oprah episodes where she gives away a car or a house, or Extreme Home Makeover, where they come in and look like heroes and do this amazing thing for 1 week. And oh my gosh, your house looks like a mansion and it's worth $3 million now. And then those trucks all leave and the cameras leave. And a few months later, they get the tax bill.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, we can't pay this tax bill, or we can't maintain the electric bill for all of these crazy things they just did to our house. And now the cameras are gone. So you don't see that part of it. And that's exactly what happens with a lot of interventions in poorer countries. People go with the camera. They go for that hero moment. They capture it on camera. It looks amazing. It feels amazing. And then, you know, a week later or 2 weeks later or a year later, what's the sustainability there? And oftentimes it's not at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Those are things that are like really important to me too. I don't want to experience something like short term, like a one and done. Like, I think if you're going to wish to have an impact, you need to be invested in the long term and the growing stages and the things that work and the things that don't work, you know?
Yes. And in researching for my ASHA presentation on this topic, I found that over 70% of these medical service trips are for about 2 weeks. That's the average length. So if you think about, you know, if you're going to perform a surgery and you have a specific goal of performing X number of surgeries, then maybe 2 weeks makes sense. But in a field like ours, that requires a lot of training, a lot of experience, a lot of cultural knowledge, a lot of background knowledge, going somewhere for 2 weeks doesn't really make a whole lot of sense in terms of the rapport we build with our patients mm-hmm. and the training that's required to, you know, provide good care.
Mm-hmm. I love that. That's like yet again, another example of how speech and language therapy just doesn't fit into a typical medical model. And they always want to like force us to fit into like a PT model or an OT model of care. And it's like what we do is just so very different. Like it doesn't align or match up very well.
Right.
Sometimes. Okay. So to kind of help give this more shape and form, to help people kind of follow along with the questions that you have prepared, like the list of 10 questions, I want you to talk a little bit about the work that you've been doing for the past 10 years, because you've partnered with like one organization and you've maintained that relationship and kept it going. So I was hoping you could tell me a little bit more about that so that when we get to the questions, we can see how they've taken shape based on your experiences.
Absolutely. So fast forwarding after my experience with Dr. Shungu in Tanzania, I actually stayed in touch with him because I had done some little fundraising events for him here and there. And after the civil war had sort of settled a bit in Congo and I had just graduated from the IHP, he invited me to go with him to the Congo as a guest. And I felt comfortable doing that because I didn't have a goal. I didn't have a mission. I was literally going as his guest to just have the experience of being in Congo. And within the first week I was there, he brought me to one of his medication distribution sites, which just so happened to be a school for the deaf in northeastern Congo, about 6 hours from the border of South Sudan, where he introduced me to Ismail, who was at the time the only audiologist in all of eastern Congo, so service population of about 3 million people.
Oh my goodness.
with one audiologist. Mm. And just in chatting with him, he found out I was a speech pathologist, which I was at the time used to having people say that they didn't really know what that meant. But his eyes lit up and he started asking me a lot of questions. And at the end of the conversation, he said, you know, can we email? Can I get your help? Because I have a lot of kids, you know, kids with Downs, kids with cerebral palsy, kids with suspected autism that I don't quite know what to do with. But they come here because I'm the only person in the area who has any knowledge in that area. So I started emailing with him. We developed a friendship over the course of a couple years. And so 2 years later, I went back as his guest and started doing some training for him and for his rehab aides and teachers, not with the goal of providing direct services, but training all of them in things to look for, things like what's the difference between speech, language, and cognition? What do we expect for recovery after stroke? What are our goals for a kid with Down syndrome who's, you know, their tongue is big? So what are their expectations for getting clear speech? Just answering questions like that. And 10 years later, I'm still involved and we do a lot of fundraising. Unfortunately, because of COVID and me having kids, the trips have been sort of put on hold. We've had to schedule and then call off 3 trips in the last year and a half, but I'm hoping to return end of this year or early next year.
And so what's the name of, is it, so I think you mentioned it's a school?
So it's called the Center for Community-Based Rehabilitation and Education, which in French the acronym ends up being the CERBC, and it is in Aru, which if you look on a map is in the teeny corner of northeast Congo.
So when you started working with Ismail about 10 years ago or so, what was the size of the school and the population of the school and his employees to now?
So he had at the time he started about 30 kids. There was a dorm. One of the great parts about the CERBC is they have a dorm, which means that kids with physical disabilities are able to access school. Not to get tangential, but access to school is a big issue there in and of itself. The schools are often far away. They're usually religiously affiliated. So most kids are walking several miles to get to school. So any kind of physical impairment really hinders access to education. So once he had the dorm, he wasn't just getting kids with hearing loss. He was getting kids with physical deformities, physical disabilities, and it just sort of exploded for him into any kid or even young adults with special needs or learning differences were showing up at his school. There is currently, I think, 120, COVID obviously changed this, but there were 120 day students who walked to the school and then 40 residential students.
That's really grown. That's impressive.
Yes.
That's amazing. I love that. Okay. So if we're living in America, our understanding of school is that it's public, it's paid by tax dollars. Children can go to school for free. They can even get food for free at school if they qualify for free or reduced price lunches. Sometimes breakfast is included in that. And then in other regions of the US, they'll even send children home with meals over the weekend sometimes. Like it's a whole thing.
Yep.
What is school system like in that area of the Congo and for that particular school?
So most of the schools in Congo are religiously affiliated. So a church that's a lot of times they're European-based church organizations that will run the school. There are some government schools too, but regardless, you pay. The CRBC currently, it is the equivalent of $160 for the year for school room and board, which when we say it sounds like nothing. It's, you know, not even a textbook for most of our college students. But in that area, most of those folks are making probably the equivalent of $50 to $60 a year.
And so it's roughly $160 just for a year. And that's including staying on the property as a dorm resident.
Correct. So what has happened in the past is that parents will save up enough money to pay for 1 year and they will drop their child off and then not come back for them. Because the expectation is if we paid for 1 year and we leave them there, someone will help take care of them because it can be that much of a financial burden. So a lot of the fundraising we do is simply supporting the tuition, room and board for current students.
And so is it also accurate that even the public schools, the children and the parents still have to pay to attend?
Correct. Yep.
So regardless of who's operating the school, whether it's a private school, a religiously affiliated school or a public school, children still have to pay to attend.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's kind of important to kind of, I don't know, lay out there for folks who just aren't
Absolutely.
Used to that kind of how things operate.
And if you think about kids with any kind of special needs that the parents are aware of, they have to make the decision, is it worth sending my child to school? Are they going to get anything out of it? Or should we just go straight to having them work in the fields? And that's a decision that a lot of parents have made that Ismail has encountered in the community. Oh, I didn't send her to school because she's deaf and I didn't think she could learn. So he now has several of his graduates, in particular, a girl named Nayana, I think she's probably 20 now, who lost her hearing from meningitis as an infant, wasn't sent to school until she was a bit older, ended up graduating from the CERBC and now works there as one of the deaf educators. And Ismail frequently sends her out in the community as sort of a model or an example of why you should still think about the importance of education for your kids, even if they have special needs.
That's really cool. That's important work. Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
Okay. So we've really kind of laid the foundation. And so now I mentioned earlier in our intro about the difference between like actually doing good work or that feeling good, like you did good work. Like you feel so good about the work you did, but was it actually good work? So you've got a list of about 10 questions to kind of self-reflect on and ask yourself before partnering with an organization to know if you're going to be doing feel-good work versus actually useful, helpful, beneficial work.
Yes.
All right, let's dive into those.
So if you are ready to travel the world and you Google, you know, opportunities abroad, there are hundreds of them. And of course, they range in quality. But the first thing I say to look out for is any mention of the words voluntourism or mission trips. Those are kind of loaded terms that if people are still using those terms, you have to wonder if you're getting into that kind of white saviorism sort of, we're here to save you and teach you what the right thing to do and also make this so fun for you because it's all about you and not the people you're helping. So those are two words that if you see them, or two terms rather, if you see them, I would raise a bit of a red flag as to what their actual goals are.
Mm.
Following that, related, is the CEO or the leader, or the decision maker of this organization, someone from the country that you're going to? Or is it another American person who sort of settled into the country and set something up that they think is really beneficial? Who's making money off of this? All really important research to do before you, you know, send in a deposit and start planning this trip. If it's not somebody local, do they have a local board of directors? Are the decisions coming from someone who's part of that culture, part of that neighborhood, and a full-time resident at the bare minimum of that country? Mm-hmm. Otherwise, there's just way too many opportunities for cultural misunderstandings and sort of misdirected goals.
Mm-hmm.
Following off of that, is it a spring break trip? Is it set up so that college kids can go for 2 weeks and, you know, put it on their resume? Or is it set up with a way that's beneficial to the service population? Do they go through, you know, do they say, oh, we've had over 10,000 volunteers or 5,000 volunteers that have come through our program? If somebody's had 5,000 volunteers come through a program, what's been the screening process for those volunteers? Is that something that's, you know, do they consider who you are and what you have to offer? Or are they just taking money and sending you on a trip to go pretend that you've helped people? Thinking about those 2 week trips, how would you feel as a parent? Someone came into your child's school or into your child's rehabilitation center or hospital from another country, didn't speak your language, and said, oh, I'm going to take care of your kid for a couple weeks, and then I'm going to go, and then someone else is going to come, and then someone else is going to come. Would you be able to trust that as a parent? And would you know how much experience that person has had? The expectation that people who are poor should just settle for whatever's offered to them is, you know, patently bigoted, even if it comes from a place of good intentions. Mm-hmm. Dr. Paul Farmer, who is the head of Partners in Health, has talked about a lot about the preferential option for the poor. We shouldn't be giving people our bare minimum. We shouldn't be giving people our trash just because they're poor.
Mm-hmm.
Going forward, does the organization's model involve placing students in the home of local families? This is a touchy one. People love the idea of culturally integrating themselves and becoming part of a family, having a host family. But there's a power dynamic here of a upper middle class white person staying in the home of someone from a poor country. How much are they being compensated? Were they coerced into taking a host? Were they, you know, sometimes it can be gimmicky. There's been some organizations in Uganda, particularly, where students go down there and stay with a host family thinking that they're helping to build a school, but it's actually just a shady landlord who then turns around and sells that building to make money for it.
Shame.
It's happened a couple of times. Somebody actually wrote, there was a whole play called Witness Uganda that was based on exactly that happening, of an organization sending American students down to build schools. They weren't schools. They were, you know, apartment buildings or shops. And as soon as the volunteers were gone, the shops were sold and families were, you know, being conned into taking hosts when they didn't really want to, but if they're desperate for the money or if somebody pressures them. So there's all sorts of weird dynamics to just be aware of before you go move in with someone in a country where you don't necessarily know that there's any regulation for these kind of organizations.
Mm.
If travel were banned, see, I wrote this before COVID, and now reflecting on it, it's even more meaningful. If travel were banned to this country the next month, would the service you provided have any carryover? Would there be any benefit from you having been there if you were gone 2 weeks later and no one replaced you? Are they training or employing folks within the community? So I especially wonder about this with teaching. Is there not any person in Tanzania, Uganda, Rwanda interested in teaching? Or do we not have the resources there to train teachers? So why are we sending teachers instead of sending someone to train people there to teach? Because that way, you know, you train someone to teach, you leave, that's a trained teacher. You go down and teach, you leave, now there's no teachers. And that's hopefully an aspect of international travel that's sort of been exposed by COVID, because a lot of these organizations have probably been abandoned, and we'll probably see the effects of that in the coming years.
Mm.
To keep going, number 8, does the organization prioritize patient rights and privacy? This is a big soapbox for me. Anybody who's been on Facebook and went through college has probably seen someone they know post pictures of brown-skinned children from Guatemala, Africa, Haiti, wherever they might have gone on a service trip in college or after college. I always ask, and I've had a few people get very upset with me, did you get the parents' permission before you posted that picture on Facebook? Because 9 times out of 10, in a volunteer situation in a foreign country, the answer is probably no. When I did an informal poll about this a couple of years ago, only half of the people I asked who had done one of these service trips had any sort of formal privacy agreement in terms of getting consent to take pictures or signing off on an agreement that they wouldn't use those pictures in a way that the parent hadn't agreed to.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be really exploitive. You know, as standard sort of best practice, we have HIPAA in the United States. We would be fired immediately if we posted a picture of one of our patients on Facebook. We should go into a foreign country, assuming the law is the same there, even though it may not be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just thinking about their autonomy, the patient's autonomy, the parent's autonomy, all the same things that are sort of built into our framework as ASHA certified clinicians, when we sign on to an employee agreement, and, you know, state and federal laws. A lot of that framework doesn't exist in these countries, but that shouldn't mean it's a free-for-all when we are there. Talking to previous volunteers is also important. When you have them reflect honestly, do they think that that opportunity was more about them or about their clients or patients or service population? Was there any progress measurement, any objective assessment? Especially with speech pathologists, if we're delivering bilingual therapy, is it anywhere within the ASHA guidelines? Are those even considered? Ask any question you'd ask before you took a CF position in terms of the ethics, the treatment model. And when it comes to these trips, are they talking more about themselves or are they talking about what they were able to do, what they were able to solve, what they were able to help patients or parents with? Or is it, you know, it opened my eyes or it gave me perspective, those me statements versus patient-based or population-based statements?
This is excellent. These are very insightful questions to ask. And I think if you can answer all of these, then you'll know what kind of experience you're getting into. And
yes,
this is a very important list. Thank you so much, Amanda, for making it and sharing it with us. This is
no problem. And these aren't coming from a place of me sort of knowing what's best all the time. A lot of those questions come from mistakes that I've made. One of the first things I did for CERBC was send them a huge box of walkers and gait trainers and crutches and orthopedic equipment, because that's one of the things that Ismail had mentioned they were lacking. I knew that they had a physical therapist there. I didn't ask questions about that physical therapist training. So we raised money, got donations, spent $800 on shipping, dealt with pirates who took the box in Somalia and sent me an email pretending to be U.S. Customs and bribing me for money. So I had to pay pirates, basically. I had to send money to pirates via PayPal to release the package. It did eventually get there. Ismail sent me a picture, and the first thing that jumped out at me is, oh God, they don't know how to use gait trainers, because they had taken a picture of a kid using it like a walker. Mm. And I thought, I made the assumption based on my knowledge without really assessing the appropriateness of what I was sending. And I felt a little foolish and then thought, okay, well, next time I'm bringing a PT with me. Mm-hmm. And which fortunately panned out, a former coworker of mine did go with me in 2015, which was amazing, and did a lot of training in using that orthopedic equipment. But like I said, I'm definitely not trying to be preachy with this stuff. Most of it comes from mistakes I've made myself.
And as you were going through this list, it also made me think, you know, we introed it by this list is a tool to help you know if you're doing feel good work versus actually useful, beneficial work to the population. And I don't want it to sound like those are two sides of a story or that they're polar opposites, because if you're doing really good work that really is benefiting people, you will feel it. You will feel good about your work.
Absolutely. You may not have the hero Oprah moment, but it certainly feels good, especially knowing I've had a almost decade long relationship with some of the staff and faculty at CERBC, and going back year after year and having the students not see me as the white lady, which in Lingala is, they will shout out Mandele, Mandele, Mandele whenever they see a white person driving down the street. But after a while, I was no longer Mandele, I was Amanda, or the sign that the deaf students had made for me. And that's huge. And that's something that you don't get if you go on a 2 or 3 week mission trip. Mm-hmm. And that for me has been much more fulfilling, knowing that Ismail can shoot me an email at 2 a.m. and expect a response from me the next day has been probably the most more low-key rewarding over the last 10 years.
Yeah, very nice. Yeah, acting as a support, you know, offering what we can to support the work that they're doing, the accomplishments that they're making.
Like, yes.
That's really cool.
And he actually just got his PhD in rehabilitation sciences in Germany.
Rock
so
on.
He picked up another language. He now speaks, I believe, 7 languages fluently. And he has 7 kids and runs the school.
That's amazing. I'm super jealous. I mean, probably not of his stress load. Like, I think he's a very, very busy individual.
Yep.
But what the accomplishments, my goodness.
Yes, absolutely amazing.
Wow, really cool. Okay. So we've talked about CERBC. No.
Yep. CERBC.
CERBC.
Yeah.
We've talked about where they were when you first met them and came in contact with the organization and the school, how they've grown, where they're at now. What are some of their current like areas of growth? Where are they looking to grow into or expand or anything like that?
Yeah. So at the moment, because of COVID, everything was kind of put into existence mode. Like, what do we need to do to survive? We were able to fundraise at the beginning of COVID to send, I think we sent about $6,000 to keep the staff and faculty paid. Now they are pretty much back to normal there. The one good thing about being as isolated and remote as they are is that COVID, fortunately, knock on wood, did not become a huge issue there. The projects that we put on hold involved a return trip with another physical therapist, speech therapists again, and an occupational therapist. That field does not exist there at all, and we have not had an OT volunteer to come with me yet. One area that kind of popped up as I was there as a huge area of need is fluency education.
Mm.
I encountered a 16-year-old boy who had been beaten. And again, trying to be sensitive to cultural differences, corporal punishment being hit is more common there. But he was being hit for having his blocks because his teacher was under the impression that he was just refusing to speak. So he came in to me to see if I could cure his stutter. This is another kind of heartbreaking thing, is the knowledge that we sort of have underlying of there is no magical pill to cure autism. There is no pill to cure stuttering. He came in asking for me to cure his stutter and having to give him the news that that's not something we can do. And in trying to talk to him about some, you know, treatments, some things he could practice and some fluency education, he mentioned that when he has blocks, his teacher hits him with a switch. So I said, oh, crud. So rather than, you know, it switched in that moment of, okay, instead of treating these kids who are coming in with fluency disorders, we need to think about a way to get to the teachers and give them a really quick overview of what stuttering is, what it's not, and how you can help it versus how you can probably do the opposite and make it worse.
Mm-hmm.
So what seems super obvious, like don't hit kids, isn't that simple when you're in Eastern Congo. So we threw together really quickly a presentation and 30 teachers ended up coming. There ended up being teachers kind of hanging out, like looking in the window. So that ended up being an unexpected area of need. So we had planned to do a lot of fluency education. I'm a generalist, so I had been looking for a volunteer who had more experience with fluency treatment and education to come with me for the next trip, which will hopefully happen next year. In terms of facilities at the school, we were fundraising for a handicap accessible bathroom. The bathroom is a latrine situation where it's a hole in the ground. They dig the hole, they cap it. Once it's filled, they move to another spot. We had fundraised, it was going to be about $4,000 to build a more sustainable bathroom with handrails and an elevated toilet seat so that the wheelchair-bound kids and other mobility-impaired kids could use the bathroom without assistance.
Mm. Very nice. Good. Yep. Oh, I like that. It's so great to be able, like, I get so excited about, like, really useful action, right?
The hardest I've ever cried. we had a well dug. And when I realized how little it cost, I thought, oh my God, how have we not thought about this for 6-7 years? Ismail just sort of mentioned it in passing that a lot of the reasons why they couldn't do more surgeries there, more ENT surgery, orthopedic surgery, is because of the lack of clean water.
Mm.
You know, they have a pump, they fill up buckets, it's coming from the river, which is not clean or treated, or they get bottled water. You can't, you know, flush out a wound with a bottle of Dasani. So he mentioned getting a well built. I said, send me the quote. We'll see what we can do. And I'm expecting something astronomical because I'm picturing building a well isn't a small project. It was under $3,000. So we fundraised for it over one Christmas. And when he sent me the picture of the looks on these kids' faces when they were just getting buckets out of the well instead of having to walk, yeah, hardest I've ever cried, I think. So now they have a well there. They have clean water. And Dr. Kapagambe is going to be the first ENT in Eastern Congo. He's finishing up his education in Uganda, and he'll be heading back to the CERBC with COVID considerations, not sure the timing, to start doing ENT work at the CERBC as well.
That's This is fantastic. Like, I'm so excited about how they're growing and they're adding more professionals to their employees and they're providing all these different services. Like, oof, I got all the feels. I love it.
Yes. Which leads me to your listeners who might obviously be wondering what they could contribute to a project like this, which if there are experienced speech therapists, and I'm not, you know, saying anything negative or dismissive of brand new, fresh, excited speech therapists, because that's obviously wonderful. But since we're training teachers and dealing with a lot of those cultural considerations, really looking for experienced, even people more experienced than me, especially that's why I've been looking for a fluency expert, a dysphasia expert, or someone who is bilingual fluent in French to consider getting involved and possibly taking a trip with me to continue the training and continue the things that we've started.
So tell me a little bit more about the language situation in the region of Congo that you're working.
Sure. So Aru was actually, it was one of the UN sites for refugees during the civil war, and then also for the issues in Darfur in South Sudan. So they have a huge, huge migrant population from all over Congo. Ismail himself is actually a refugee. He fled Goma with his family in the middle of the night after his sister was murdered for being involved with the politics in the region. So several languages, Swahili, Lingala, and then Luganda from the Ugandan side, because it's close to the Ugandan border, and then other dialects and people coming down from South Sudan as well. If you go to school in Congo, you are educated in French. So the folks who have gone to school are fluent French speakers, and then very, very little English. Sometimes people who have gone to school in Uganda, which was an English colony, have some English or were educated in English. In order to get any medical training, you really need to speak English, because most of the medically based programs, like the audiology program, the ENT program, the only speech therapy program, those are all in Kampala and Uganda, which is English based.
Okay. All right. That kind of helps work it out a little bit. So then the students at the CERBC are, all their classes and all their instruction is in French.
It's in French or in ASL, because there's actually not a Congolese sign language. So just because the most of the trainers were coming from Uganda, they use ASL. So I actually, the kids who don't speak French, I'm actually able to communicate better with the deaf kids with my rudimentary signs than I am when they're, you know, verbal speakers and speaking Lingala, which I've only picked up on conversationally. But yeah, if you are a fluent ASL user, you will definitely be able to communicate with the kids in the deaf program.
Cool. There's a lot going on there. There's like so much to offer, to do, like opportunities to work. Okay. Well, that's amazing. Amanda, this was really fun. Thank you so much. I've really appreciated this look into the last 10 years of your partnership. I've loved learning about CERBC and the incredible work that they're doing and that they continue to do for their community. That's just really cool. Yay. I love it.
It's definitely a feel-good place. And the volunteers who have come down there with me are always ready to go back. Mm. So once once the COVID situation is over, I'm definitely going to be actively organizing a return trip.
Cool. All right. So if people want to find how they might assist in some of that work, how might they reach out to you or learn more about CERBC?
So unfortunately, we have definitely slacked on keeping the website updated, but www.cerbc.org is up and running. And I believe my email address is on there and easily accessible. But if not, it's mandacate82@gmail.com. And anyone who has questions can feel free to email me about it.
All right, cool. Well, thank you, Amanda. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed this conversation with Amanda on the ethical and cultural considerations to have in mind when volunteering overseas as an SLP. I know for me, this kind of work can be really impactful. And I would want to make sure that it would have a lasting, positive impact. You know, I don't want my good intentions to get in the way of doing good work. So it's worth a moment to kind of stop and reflect on the things that Amanda covered in this episode. And with that in mind, the discussion guide for this episode is in the show notes on speechuncensored.com. I recommend getting a group of 3 or 4 SLPs together to dig a little deeper into this topic with the questions listed in the discussion guide. I feel like it's in this group conversation that we get a chance to apply what we learn, hear other perspectives, and kind of unpack this information to really grow from it. A big thanks to Laura Miller for her terrific audio editing skills. And I would be honored if you would post a thoughtful review on Apple Podcasts so other SLPs can find the podcast and join us on this journey. And I'm really glad that you have spent some of your time today with the Speech Uncensored podcast. And I hope the material that we've covered has nourished your mind so that your practice can flourish. Now I hope you get out there and be awesome.